Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mike Rowe is our guest this hour, and this guy is hard to introduce because he's done so many different things. Many of you are familiar with him. He has a new show now, Wednesdays on CNN, so you can watch it tonight. Somebody's got to do it, and it's about people who perform unique jobs. I saw one of the shows last night, and I got to tell you, these jobs are really, really unique. You'll also know him for his more than 10 years as the dirtiest man on TV, host and executive producer of the Discovery Channel's Dirty Jobs. He also runs a nonprofit, which is a very interesting one, Micro Works Foundation. And essentially, he calls it a PR organization for the trades and the importance of people who have skills. And maybe we need more people with skills than we need people with college degrees. He's, I don't know if he's really an opera singer or not. He says that in 1984, he faked his way into the Baltimore Opera to get his union card and to meet girls. And he auditioned for the QVC shopping channel and was promptly hired after talking about a pencil for nearly 8 minutes. We won't ask him to do that this hour, although I would like to hear that at some time. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Mike as we talk about skilled trade and the interesting jobs that you didn't even know existed and the dirty work that people do and the importance of having skills and maybe adjusting our educational system accordingly. Here's how you reach our conversation this hour. Any hour, as a matter of fact, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Kathleen.
Are you really an opera singer?
Well, you know, I mean, that's like saying I'm a skier just because I can get down the mountain, or a golfer just because I played 18 months. I did it. It was the shortest way for me to Forrest Gump my way into the entertainment business. And as luck would have it, I wound up liking it more than I thought. I wound up being only marginally better at it than I thought I would be. And the girls, in fact, were both plentiful and good-natured.
Excellent. So, what more can you ask for?
Not much.
No, that's right. But then you were on to other things. I did see one of the shows, and it was just, you know, all these whooping cranes have stayed with me today. This story you did on the whooping cranes, and as you know, there's a Wisconsin connection. God bless the people who are trying to increase their numbers and the lengths they go to increase their numbers. It's amazing.
It is. You know, the thing that struck me first and foremost about the story, of course, is anyone who cares more about a species that's not their own is always interesting. And you know, we got a line on a guy named Dr. French back in Maryland, my hometown, in fact, and he dedicated his life to reinvigorating the whooping crane, and that was really all I needed to know. The crew and I went there, spent the day with he and his merry group of volunteers. We all wore burkas because you can't confuse the the young crane. You know, they're imprinting every second of every day on whatever is nearest them. So the goal really isn't to look so much like a crane as it is to not look like a human. And we just went about the process of raising crane, as it were. And while we did that in Maryland, actually, the story started the way most of our stories do. Somebody on my Facebook page sent me a video, and the video that I originally saw was of an outfit called Operation Migration in your neck of the woods.
Right.
Who take the whole process to the next level. They not only dress up in burkas, but they take the cranes in more of an adolescent phase and literally teach them to migrate and fly. And they get in an ultralight, and they get themselves up in the air a few hundred feet, a few thousand feet, and cranes in formation follow them for the first time in their life. And these guys fly their ultralights all the way down to the southeast and essentially teach the cranes how to migrate.
It's such a story. And at one point, they're also earnest, too, and really delightful people. But at one point, Dr. French talks about this being the morally right thing to do, that the cranes have, well, as much a right to be around as we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a worldview, you know. And
right.
The point of my show is not to confirm it or challenge it, but to merely bear witness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's on the one hand, you've got a very specific passion that these volunteers and these experts, you know, completely immerse themselves in. But on the other hand, you know, this is broadcast television, and you know, a lot of people watch, and a lot of people might have a slightly different take on the whole, on the whole topic of an endangered species. And, you know, always under the surface of these shows linger much larger ideas that we typically don't deal with on TV, but sort of matriculate into a really robust conversation after the fact.
Right.
Well, and that's what happened here.
Yeah, and I like that description that you're bearing witness. That's a good thing to do with your life.
You know, I'm old enough to remember Charles Kuralt.
Sure.
And George Plimpton and Studs Terkel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these guys did a kind of journalism that, you know, you just don't see much anymore. It was, I mean, truly immersive, and they all had a different take on the world, but fundamentally, none of them really wanted to write about anything or report on anything until they had experienced it, at least in some measure, firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think bearing witness is an important thing to do, and certainly with respect to managing expectations. It's important for me because I don't have any actual qualifications.
Oh, but you've done all those jobs. You could do just about anything now, don't you think?
I think that I could create the illusion of competence in a
right.
variety of areas for short bursts, but I don't know that I could maintain it.
What's on tonight's show?
Let's see. Tonight, I met a guy, again, via email. Somebody told me I should meet Mutt Merritt. And Mutt is basically dedicated his life to reinvigorating the oyster population in Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up back in that part of the country, and I know a fair amount about the impact oysters have on the Mid-Atlantic economy, but I had no idea just how involved the politics of the Bay are, the environmental issues of the Bay, the role of the oyster in the Bay. And it was just really fascinating to spend the day with one guy who more or less is in the center of all of that, trying to not only reinvigorate the oysters themselves, but keep the politicians in Annapolis and the watermen on the Eastern Shore from, you know, blowing a hole in the bottom of our collective boat. So it's just a fascinating challenge and a really fun show and a really interesting guy who, when the dust settles, what he's really doing is presiding over what he would call oyster orgies. He is figured out a way through a kind of artificial insemination to increase the oyster population a thousandfold. And, he's up to his neck in it. And then we wind up, very randomly, we wind up in Kansas City for the second story with a guy who has more or less created and is overseeing the most successful non-traditional marching band in the country.
Hmm.
And they're called the Marching Cobras. And these are a lot of kids from the difficult side of the tracks who would probably never otherwise have a chance to leave Kansas City. But because of this band and because of this guy, Don, their teacher and mentor, they've been all over the world, from Paris to, you know, the White House.
Yeah.
They play and they march for dignitaries. I had no idea they existed. Spent a few hours with them, and ye shall be restored.
Great, and you're glad they exist. Let's, sure. Before we go to phone calls, and we have many of them coming in already, I do want to talk about your foundation, your PR campaign for good jobs in the skilled trades. And why don't you start, if you would? I'm always amazed by people like your grandfather, this highly skilled tradesman, eighth grade education, could build a house without a blueprint.
Yeah, in fact, he did more than once. He only went to the eighth grade, but he was one of those guys who was born seemingly with a mysterious chip in the back of his head. And consequently, he could take a tractor apart, he could take an engine apart, he could take a watch apart, put it back together. He could fix, build anything. By the time he was 30, he was a master electrician, plumber, steam fitter, pipe fitter, welder, mechanic. And he was heroic in his day because he was the guy you could call, and he woke up clean, he came home dirty, and somewhere in between, a problem was solved. And, you know, I saw him as larger than life and heroic. And today, I think he would be largely transparent to most people. Those skills, that kind of knowledge, is just not as valued as it was. And as a consequence, I think we collectively have inadvertently nurtured a skills gap. We've been promoting one form of education, specifically a four-year degree, as the best path for the most people. And we've been doing it in a way that perhaps unconsciously marginalizes and diminishes all other forms of learning. Higher education on the right, alternative education on the left. And so the foundation that you mentioned happened right in the middle of dirty jobs. We were late in 2008, early 2009, height of the recession. And everywhere I looked, the headlines talked about unemployment at 9-10%. But everywhere I went in the course of shooting the show, I was seeing help wanted signs. It was very strange. You know, there was another narrative going on that wasn't getting a lot of press, and it had to do with the fact that there was a skills gap. And something like 3-3.5 million jobs, many in manufacturing and the trades, were available, but employers were really struggling to find people who were willing to hit the reset button, learn a truly useful skill, show up early, stay late, and get to work. And so I know it reeks of Horatio Alger and a lot of, you know, traditional ethos, but it was real, and it was such a part of the show I was doing that I thought it might be nice to, you know, try and give something back to the industries that had allowed me to do well. So we set up a simple foundation. We offered work ethic scholarships, which were modest stipends to kids who were willing to make a case for themselves to affirmatively pursue a skill that was actually in demand. And I just thought it would be useful to look at scholarship opportunities not just through the lens of academic achievement or athletic achievement or talent or need-based, but in terms of work ethic. And that hit a chord. We partnered with a number of organizations who were like-minded, raised and gave away a few million dollars, and along the way tried to talk about the whole notion in terms of a PR campaign for skilled labor and hard work. A good-natured, non-earnest PR campaign that attempted to put alternative educational opportunities on the same plane as higher academic pursuits. Long story short, it did strike a chord, and it grew way beyond my facility to manage it, but I'm still very, very much involved with it on a day-to-day basis, and MicroWorks is out there.
It's a wonderful thing. It's good. We're going to welcome phone calls for Mike. Mike Rowe is our guest. His new show is Somebody's Got to Do It, and it's on CNN. You can see it tonight. As a matter of fact, the season has just recently started. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Luke in Evansville, Indiana is our first caller for you, Mike. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Kathleen. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Pleasure. I was born and raised in the Fox Valley, the Appleton area, and well, it always was, you know, paper. You know, my extended family and many people I know, their families worked in the paper industry, and those have been slowly and gradually dying away. In fact, in around 2005, 2006, my father's mill that he worked at, only a couple years after installing a new machine, decided to close up and head down south. And I just want to ask, how do you think we could keep skilled labor in the state, particularly in you know, the Midwest?
Chris, you still there?
Oh, yeah, he's here.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, obviously, that's such a massive question, and the only reason I would hedge on giving you a really simple, direct answer is because I don't think one exists. You know, it's really tempting for people, especially people we elect, to make grand proclamations and say things that somehow resonate with everyone in the same way, but the skilled labor issue is, it's different geographically. And a lot of the time I spend talking about this, I'm talking to people on the coasts who really have no idea of the biography you just talked about and the day-to-day reality of you know, living and working in these parts of the country. But I will say, in a really general way, that the trades and hard work need a PR campaign of their own, because the thing I believe, and I, you know, it's probably a little controversial, but from what I've seen, I really don't believe the skills gap and the crumbling infrastructure and offshoring and currency devaluation and all of the things that we typically hear discussed as problems. I don't really think they're problems in and of themselves. I think they're symptoms of something else. And I think that something else is the country's larger relationship with work and with the prevailing definition of a good job. I think that a lot of things change over time, but one of the things we can control is the idea that certain vocations are more worthy of pursuit than others. And I think over the last two generations, we've made a fundamental mistake in identifying certain opportunities as aspirational and certain opportunities as subordinate. And I think now we're starting to see the fallout of doing that. So that's kind of a long way, Chris, of saying that whatever the solution is in towns like yours, in states like Wisconsin, in states like California, it has to start with a new relationship with the definition of meaningful work and a good job. Because the front line of this conversation is around kitchen tables with parents and their kids and in guidance counselors' offices and in classrooms. That's where we start. And, you know, it's pernicious. In 1978, I still remember my guidance counselor pointing to a poster on his wall that had a picture of a graduate holding a degree standing next to a mechanic holding a wrench. And the mechanic was covered with grease and filth and looked very sad. And the graduate was looking optimistic off toward a rising sun. And the caption said, "Work smart, not hard." That poster was actually a PR campaign for college. And when I told my counselor that I was going to go to a community college instead, he told me that would be a mistake, and he pointed to that poster, and he said, "Which one of those guys do you want to be?" So, you know, I never forgot that, and I still think that there's a really powerful inertia at work in the country that says, look, if you don't go this way, heads up, you're liable to wind up stuck over here. If we don't change that, all the rest of the stuff is going to be an uphill battle.
Well, I think there's a common belief, Mike, and it's been reinforced by many economists who say, look at how much money you're going to make if you have a college degree in America compared with what you'll have if you don't have a college degree. And the disparity in salary appears to be huge. But you would say that there are a lot of skilled jobs that pay very nicely, thank you.
I'd say that I can bend the numbers to suit whatever conclusion I want to draw. And I've heard many times the exact juxtaposition you just described. But if you really think about it, of course, if you have a college degree, you could very easily conclude that you'll do better than if you didn't, if you're only looking at the finances of a thing. But to whom are you comparing? If you don't have a college degree, you might be a person who didn't finish high school. Or maybe you did finish high school but got no training. Maybe you got some training but not enough. Or maybe you got the right kind of training that wasn't a college degree or not something that was reflected by a diploma, and then maybe you got hooked up with the right kind of job that flatters the training you got. Now, if you compare that person with a person with a four-year degree, then you'll see some pretty amazing things. And I would just say be really careful about the generalizations of degree versus no degree, because no degree doesn't mean no training. It doesn't mean no education. It doesn't mean no apprenticeships. When you take apprenticeships and on-the-job training opportunities and sort of, you know, lump them in with not graduating from high school, then you've got a control group that's kind of out of control. And I think it's also a trap to say, well, look at how much you can make versus how much you won't. It's a little more complicated than that. And I think the number that impresses me most is looking right now at the BLS most recently said there are 3.6 million jobs currently available. The percentage of those available jobs that require a four-year degree is very, very skinny compared to what's not. I think it's over 70% of the available opportunities require training, very specific types of training. So, you know, when you look at all of that, and then regarding money, the other number to me that's most impressive isn't what you might be able to earn with a four-year degree. It's how much debt do we collectively hold on student loans. Right now we're at 1.1 trillion.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
So, you know, we're lending money we don't have to kids who really aren't going to be able to pay it back to educate them for jobs that don't really exist. And that's something I think that needs to inform the whole conversation.
Mike Rowe is our guest this hour. Mike has a new program. For a long time, he was the host and executive producer of Discovery Channel's Dirty Jobs. He also has a really worthwhile foundation, the Mike Rowe Works Foundation, to reinvigorate the skilled trades. And he is now on CNN with a relatively new show, which will be on tonight. Somebody's got to do it. And we're welcoming phone calls for him. We have one line open if you'd like to call Luke. Thank you for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tomorrow at this time, Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman will be joining us for a discussion of the Obama presidency. You probably know that he's been pretty critical of the president, but he has a cover story for Rolling Stone magazine, where some of the best reporting is being done these days. And he comes to the president's defense. So Paul Krugman is with us tomorrow. Well, we'll be back to your phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go back to phone calls for Mike Rowe and Kevin in Madison. Hello, Kevin.
Yeah, good afternoon. Mike, your foundation is spot on. A little bit of a background. I graduated from a technical high school in 1975. And right out of that, I learned printing and graphic arts. I was able to open a printing business before I turned 20, which I ran for 10 years, and then decided I had to go to college because of all I heard. Well, geez, you got to go to college, got to go to college. So, yeah, I went to college, got an architectural degree, and worked in that field for a number of years. But now, you know, I'm in my 50s, and what I lean on now is being able to fix stuff. And that goes back to, you know, the technical training. And I see it all around me. There aren't people that can actually fix things. And my skills, you know, both as a carpenter and plumbing, electrical, and all that, which I've learned, you know, are really in high demand. And that really stems back to, you know, that technical training where we fix these machines and made them work. And it was the, you know, best experience of my life, really, is, you know, graduating from that school.
What do you fix?
Yeah, comments on.
What do you fix, Kevin?
Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
What do you fix?
I work on buildings. I do remodeling, and you know, called in to do all kinds of handyman services. You know,
great.
I can fix just about anything.
Oh, that's great, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one of the things that you said that really stuck out, Kevin, is, and something I think people forget about when they look at learning a trade versus not learning a trade, is the whole entrepreneurial opportunity that comes built in with mastering a trade. That doesn't necessarily happen as often from the academic side. On dirty jobs, you know, it's funny, people tend to find what they look for. And people would look at dirty jobs. We did 300 of them.
Oh, my.
One of the first ones is right there in Madison. Les Swanson has a septic tank business not too far from where you are. And, you know, Les was a guidance counselor for years and walked away from it because he wanted to have his own business. And he wanted to, you know, I think his exact words when I asked him why he left that field, he said he was tired of dealing with other people's crap and wound up in the septic business.
Oh,
so,
my.
You know, there's enough irony to go around.
Right.
But the point is, you could watch Dirty Jobs, and you could see an homage to blue-collar work. You could see a cautionary tale, depending on your background. Or you could see an inspirational look at people who did the kind of jobs that make civilized life work. What most people didn't see, but that was always there, were the small businesses and the entrepreneurs that grew out of the pursuit of a skill. We probably had 40, maybe 50 multimillionaires on the show. We never talked about it because that wasn't really the point of the show. It was never meant to be a polemic. And plus, they just didn't look like millionaires. They were covered in stuff that most people run the opposite way from.
Right.
But the opportunity to create your own business around a truly useful skill is as much for sale today as it's ever been.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. And how in the world did you create the kinds of jobs that you've had for yourself? I mean, I talk about an eclectic resume. It's just amazing.
Well, most of it is just the result of indecision. And, you know, I wanted very badly to follow in my granddad's footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to build a house without a blueprint.
Mm.
And, you know, most of the people in my family, farmers and tradesmen, can do that. I didn't get the gene. I don't know if it's recessive or just, you know, a cruel twist of fate, but I washed out of all the shop classes.
Oh,
I mean, really, it was frustrating. And it was my granddad who told me when I was 17, he said, look, if you want to be a tradesman, you can do it. You just need a different toolbox. And, you know, the idea of being a tradesman, a real freelancer in the classic sense of the word, appealed to me fundamentally. And I realized by the time I got out of high school that's what I was in love with. It wasn't about learning a traditional trade. I thought it was. But for me, it was more of an approach to work. And so, you know, way leads on to way, as Frost said. And the opera led to home shopping, and home shopping
led to,
you know, Broadway.
Right.
And
sure.
And the next thing you know, you're freelancing in Hollywood.
Right.
So, yeah, that's right. The long answer to how I wound up with 300 jobs before Dirty Jobs.
Yeah, it's a good story. Cooper in Milwaukee. Hi, Cooper.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I just kind of wanted to share my story and give a commendation for Mike's foundation here because I think it's right on with some of us. I'm 27 years old, and I followed the traditional path that was laid out in my suburban community that you finish high school, you go get your four-year degree, get a job. And I graduated in 2009 when, you know, the depth of the recession meant that none of us had jobs out there. So worked in political campaigns in Chicago for about a year and a half and moved up here to Milwaukee to take a job working at a solar module manufacturer in the River Valley. And yeah. Subsequently, having gone out of business, I've been looking for other work, and I linked up with a solar installer, so I'm actually working still in my field, but I'm also trying to seek an apprenticeship through my company right now to become an electrician. And I think this whole vibe of hitting the reset for guys and gals in my generation is just right on, and I would love to hear a little bit more if Mike has any ideas about his PR approach to opening people's eyes to what a good paying job is and what opportunities there are outside of the traditional path for, you know, most high school graduates, at least of my oak. So thanks a lot for having me on and for doing the work you're doing, Mike.
Thank you, thanks, Cooper. Great story from you.
No, it's nice to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So he's asking, you know, what specifically can be done from a PR standpoint to actually challenge stigmas and stereotypes that affect the definition of a good job. And look, PR is hard. First of all, it's hard because most people dismiss it as just PR. And most PR is lousy because it just reeks. But the good stuff, the authentic stuff, actually works. And, you know, I've been thinking about a campaign that I know you and a lot of your listeners will remember. But do you remember the Indian on the side of the highway weeping?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So that came out of a campaign called Keep America Beautiful, long before there was any talk of green. It was a real problem in the 40s and 50s. Our relationship with litter as a country was horrible. We would have picnics and just leave our stuff, throw stuff out the window. Nice people littered like reprobates. It was extraordinary. And so a consortium in 1953 came together, government organizations, NGOs, big business, and concerned citizens, and said, look, we need to fundamentally challenge the country's relationship with pollution. Keep America Beautiful was born, and over the course of a generation and a half, maybe two generations, it actually moved the needle. It changed the way people thought about litter. It's actually still around. And I think something similar, some sort of corollary has to happen vis-a-vis the country's relationship with work. We need to challenge it on a fundamental level. I don't know if that involves, you know, weeping Indians on the highway, but it does involve a steady drip. And it's going to take a lot of different ideas to do that. That poster I mentioned in my guidance counselor's office, this is a very, very, very small example. But remember, the caption said, work smart, not hard. And that began as the PR campaign for higher education. It actually turned into a platitude. If you Google it right now, you'll see thousands of pages with work smart, not hard. It's popped up. It's a bromide. And part of the point I'm trying to articulate is that I think it's very bad advice, and I think we took it in a very general way. I think we took it. So I recreated that poster, and I changed the caption to say work smart and hard. I crossed out not, wrote in and I started selling them for $10. The money went to the scholarship fund, and we sold tens of thousands.
Oh, my goodness.
Many of which are hanging in high schools right now in different parts of the country. So that's a tiny thing, but it's imagery. it's metaphor, it's iconography, mm-hmm. or it matters, you know.
Right,
so,
right.
So finding a way to start the conversation on a granular level, that's important. So, I would do that. Oh, and also regarding Cooper's question, you got to think differently about mobility. We used to be willing to move a lot more readily than we are now, and I think I understand why, but it doesn't really matter. The truth is, some of the best opportunities today require you to relocate, and you know, that's a whole separate conversation, but it's important to acknowledge. You know, if you're willing to move to North Dakota and work on heavy equipment, you're going to make $150,000 a year, no doubt about it.
Ooh, Val in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. I'd like to preface my comments by saying I'm a retired locomotive engineer, and that is a job is highly skilled, has a lot of responsibility, and when you got done with your job, really felt like you accomplished something. These are very difficult jobs, and a lot of times people don't want to acknowledge that a job that's not a college degree job is a difficult job. But my comment was, it seems to me the people you're talking about are the ones that you want around if the electricity and computers should ever go down for good.
Absolutely. You're right. Thank you very much, Val. Isn't that true?
Oh, are you kidding?
Right.
One of the prime directives of Dirty Jobs was the idea that the grid goes down. Look, if you flick the switch and the lights don't come on, if you flush the toilet
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't do what it's supposed to
mm-hmm.
do, I give it 2 days before you got a riot.
Right, exactly. I know.
After a week, you've got a Stephen King novel.
Right.
And after that, you don't want to be around. It's Walking Dead.
Exactly. In our house, it's momentarily, the washing machine broke. I can't get you do it now. Somebody.
Run for your lives.
Exactly. Take care of it. Thank you, Val, very much for your call. Melody in Washington Island, Wisconsin. Hi, Melody.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Mike, I have followed your career with interest. I am the daughter of a commercial fisherman, so I especially enjoy Deadliest Catch, a Norwegian one at that, so having grown up here on Washington Island. And my grandfather had something like the chip that your grandfather had in his head. He had a sixth grade education and built homes and barracks all over the country without blueprints. So the reason I'm calling is that my stepson was in Iraq twice with the Marines, came home and went to college, was part of that first graduating class of veterans that President Obama addressed at Ohio State year before last, and couldn't find a job in the field that he trained in. So he's very interested in really starting a career. He's madly in love with his girlfriend, and they want to start home in life. And so he went and he trained in welding, became a journeyman, did that whole thing, and has had a tremendous problem with getting work through the union. He goes to the union hall every morning. He's had a few jobs, but mostly one of the guys he went to school with said to him recently, they didn't know how he got in. You generally have to know somebody, and you definitely have to know somebody to get the best jobs, which is kind of what unions were created to get rid of, but essentially, that's the block that he's found, and I was wondering if you have any input on that.
I can tell you just generally that, I mean, if I'm going to touch a third rail, that's probably it. There's a difference today between work and labor, and the business of working with and through a union is just straight up fascinating and ephemeral and constantly changing. You know, in 1984, for me, and this isn't a direct answer to your question, but it's as close as I can come to articulating the weirdness of navigating through the organizations that sometimes dictate who works and who doesn't. I wanted very much to act. I wanted to get in commercials. I wanted to be in television. To do that, I needed my Screen Actors Guild card or my AFTRA card, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. I couldn't get either. The market was essentially closed to me, and I couldn't get SAG work unless I had a SAG card, and I couldn't get my SAG card unless I had done SAG work. And for about a year, I was in the same position as your son. I just couldn't find the kind of work I wanted. Now, I got lucky because I learned that there was another union, a guild called AGMA, which was the American Guild of Musical Artists. And if I could somehow get my way into that, I could buy my union card in the unions that I really needed to be in. And so AGMA oversaw the opera. That's why I learned the shortest aria I could find, Puccini, the coat aria, and I auditioned. And I somehow got in.
That's a great story.
And so once I was in, I was able to buy my union cards. Now, I wound up liking the opera more than I thought I would, so I stuck around for 7 years. But the point is, I know I'll get a lot of flack for this, but you just can't depend on the union or the union hall to get you work. You might be able to get a better shake or a better deal depending on the job that you get, but I can only tell you that from my experience, in the end, it's a dangerous thing to depend too heavily on the company you work for or the union who represents you, especially with a skill like welding. Because right now, I just talked to Ingersoll Rand, Bechtel, Caterpillar. These guys, they have thousands of openings for welders, and they're paying real money. But the trick, like I just said to Cooper, it's not necessarily happening in your zip code. And it's a hassle, but it's a reality. If you're a talented welder who's willing to move, if I had that skill, I'd either be down in the Gulf or in Dickinson or Williston, North Dakota, right now, because those guys are writing their own tickets.
Mike Rowe is our guest this hour. He has a new show, Somebody's Got to Do It, that has just started on CNN, and you can see it tonight. It's fascinating, the people that he spends time with, and they're entrepreneurs, and they're saving whooping cranes and building incredible sets that you wonder how in the world people can do this in Las Vegas. Some of the shows going into fire, going to water from 80 feet about in the auditorium. People who are making neon signs, changing the face of Austin, and many other stories. Tonight's is on oysters. But many of you know him. You can tell from the phone calls coming in that he was for a long time known as the dirtiest man on TV. He was the host and producer of the Discovery Channel's Dirty Jobs. So he is with us this hour. And he also has a foundation, the Mike Rowe Works Foundation, whose purpose is to reinvigorate skilled trades and get the stigma erased from skilled trades. They're not as important as trades where you need to go to college. So here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. We have time for a few more phone calls. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to phone calls for Mike Rowe. Andy in Prairieville is next. Hey, Andy.
Hey, how's it going? Mike, big fan of yours. I really appreciate what you're doing. I'll be 30 this Friday.
Happy birthday.
I was born and raised in Milwaukee. I just moved out to Ferryville, which is in Crawford County, Wisconsin, about 30 miles south of La Crosse, a year and a half ago. The work was kind of dry. But I am a union journeyman carpenter, by the way. I did the four-year apprenticeship. Work was dry in Milwaukee. Picking up now, but now that I'm out of there, it doesn't matter. I called the hall in La Crosse, and they said, when can you be here? That next day, I packed up my truck and my tools and stayed in a duck hunting shack, and I've been working ever since. Now I just bought a farm, and they're screaming for guys out here right now with that are willing to get up and go to work. As far as the gap goes, I wholeheartedly agree with it. Being from Milwaukee, I do know that for a fact that the SHOP program across Milwaukee Public Schools has been dismantled. All the machinery, all that stuff is just closed. Yep. There was it used to be called Boys Tech. It's Bradley Tech now, a technical high school. and they don't even offer any kind of shop program now. Now it's more computer-based and, you know, desk jobs. And I really think we need to change the idea, you know, like people who go to work for a living and work hard should be proud of that. And what we did by steering, turning people off by it is really affecting our economy greatly, I feel.
Mike.
Yeah, he's right. You're absolutely right, Andy. I don't know what they called it when you were in high school, but when I was in high school, it wasn't just shop. That's what we called it shorthand. The actual title was the industrial arts.
Right.
Art, right? There was art in craftsmanship. There was art in work and labor and shop. And we arbitraged the art out of the very term, you know? And when we do that, well, you just take the luster off of the opportunity. It's such a dumb thing to do, but we do it. And, you know, there was a lot of press when the arts began to be cut from high school, the arts being theater and music and the stuff that I relied upon for my trade. But we didn't see anywhere near the same press when the industrial arts started to get cut. And those cuts were much, much deeper and much, much more profound. So if you really want to try and draw a straight line between the lack of skilled tradesmen today and something, well, draw it straight to the conspicuous absence of the industrial arts. Because at the most impressionable moment of a kid's life, when all the opportunities that are available are spread before him or her, we took a big chunk of those opportunities off the table because we made them something less than aspirational. We took the artistry out of the work. And if you take the artistry out of anything from digging a hole to running pipe to building a foundation, what do you replace it with linguistically? The answer, almost always, is drudgery. And so what we used to look at as artistic and beautiful and craft-driven has become subordinate and something not good, something you want to avoid. It's a shame. But
you know,
back
it,
to the earlier point, words have power, you know. They really do.
And the darn thing, Mike, is that we should all have some of those basic skills. I mean, it's ridiculous to not be able to fix things in your house, to have some basic knowledge. A lot of us don't have any of that.
Now, look, I wrote a one-page book a couple of years ago called Profoundly Disconnected. And really, it was the shortest way I could find to talk about my own relationship with the skilled trades. And I think that I can't be alone. Most people don't really have a clear understanding of where their food comes from, where their electricity comes from, where their housing comes from. These are the fundamental things upon which we all rely, and most of us are disconnected in some way, shape, or form from them. So, you know, last time I had the pleasure to yell at Congress, I was invited to testify in front of the Senate about this very thing. And I said, look, guys, I'm addicted. I'm here today as an addict. I'm addicted to smooth roads, smooth runways, affordable energy, reliable, affordable food, indoor plumbing. You know, and we have to start the conversation by acknowledging the fact that we all share that basic addiction. And why is it that we've become so unimpressed? Why aren't we still gobsmacked when we flick on the light,
right,
or the switch and the light comes on?
Right, I know.
You know,
radio, TV, oh my gosh, it's amazing.
It's unbelievable.
Right.
But look, we're walking around right now. I'll say 98% of your listeners have within their reach right now.
We have 15 seconds left, too.
A smartphone.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Forget it. It's not a smartphone. It's a network. Your listeners. entrepreneurs are broadcasters in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
If we're not blown away by that, I don't know what's going to
happen. Yeah, I know. Thank you, Mike. It was just been a great hour. Thank you so much, and we'll watch you on TV tonight.
I'm glad somebody is. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Mike Rowe, our guest, and his show, Somebody's Got to Do It, is on CNN. It's early in the season, and you can see it tonight. That was fun. Thanks to Scott Myers and KP Whaley for producing this program. A reminder, tomorrow, Paul Krugman will be with us, economist who wrote a piece supporting President Obama on the cover of the Rolling Stone. That's tomorrow. Thanks for listening.